A lot of people host dinner parties with their friends, but our next guest says you can nourish your mind and your body with a philosophy dinner club. We're going to talk about philosophy this hour and how to bring it into our daily lives. How about you? Do you think about philosophy on a daily basis, or is it just maybe a class you took in college or a segment into high school that didn't seem like it applied to you? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you talk about philosophy? How do you define it? Call 800-642-1234 or email us, talk@WPR.org. Marietta McCarty is with us. Her new book is The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, Monthly Conversation, Music, and Recipes. She taught philosophy at Piedmont Virginia Community College for 2 decades. Her other books include Little Big Minds, Sharing Philosophy with Kids, and How Philosophy Can Save Your Life. Marietta, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, sometimes when I think of philosophy, I'll be honest, it seems like it's a highfalutin brain exercise for the academics, but you've spent your career, I guess, making the case that philosophy is too important to leave to the philosophers. Why?
That's exactly right. I found in the study of philosophy how very practical and useful it was for me. And you were talking about how to define philosophy, and I define it as the art of clear thinking. It's emptying the mind of the clutter and the noise and the unfounded opinions and assumptions we may have and making room for more clarity about ideas that are really essential to good living, gratitude, generosity, humility, whatever that may be, how to simplify our lives. And I think it's really unfortunate that I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, oh, philosophy, I remember that course I took for a couple of months in college. And really, it is so useful. I think people really like to come together and have conversation and communicate in a genuine kind of way and think about the good life and what our priorities should be. And whether it's the children I've taken philosophy to, my college students, or the many diners and readers who keep in touch with me, they're finding that how much this is nourishing their lives to come together, learn about other cultures, and to talk about ideas that really matter. So in my book, I've chosen 12 topics and 12 places in the world so that dinner clubs can meet once a month and experience January in Japan, let's say, or we're in September in Kenya, and talk about a topic. Talk about the culture, listen to some music from that culture, and then eat some food. And the world becomes much bigger and also in a way much more intimate.
Why food? Why is food such an important part of the equation here?
Well, discussion and conversation have always been a part of philosophizing for me. And solitude is great, reflection is key, but sometimes we discover things together that can't be delivered by solitude. And what brings people together better than food? I think that, we have the expression comfort food. Maybe all food is comfort food. The soothing atmosphere, the carafes being passed, the bread is breaking. And I think food is an icebreaker, and I think it's a relationship maker. I think that food is something happens when we come together and eat and pass the something at the table and take time to be together.
You've been doing these philosophy dinner clubs, right? You didn't just start this for the book. This is something that's part of your life, isn't it?
That's right.
And do your friends, are they suspicious when you invite them over for supper? Is the food just a bait, but they know, oh, she's gonna bring up some philosophical issue and throw it at us?
Well, I've managed to work it that I'm usually the one that's invited to their
house. Aha.
So that's working really well for me. And what people are doing in my town, here in Charlottesville in Virginia, is they've started these dinner clubs, and many of them are ongoing. And what this book does is it sort of gives them permission to try recipes and things that they might not have made before. And the topics that I've chosen that I think are so important, they are topics that I think we should be able to talk about. Well, persistence and grace, for example. Simple pleasures is another one. Decision making. They're not necessarily political. They're not religious. They're things that I think in my travels with philosophy are important to be talked about. So my friends aren't suspicious. They sort of they sort of know what's going to happen, and they're very eager for it. The book's only been out about a week, but in preparation, in writing this book, Rob, I had people all over the country cooking and testing and tweaking the recipes and actually having the dinner parties with the particular topic in mind. And, oh, the pure pleasure they derived from it was incredible. The stories that were told, the relationships that were formed. So it's just wonderful information coming back my way.
So let's talk through how a dinner night, a philosophy dinner night, might work. You mentioned September was a Kenyan theme. Is that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
If I'm a guest, do I have to do some homework before I show up?
Yes, you do.
Uh-oh.
But it's very pleasant. It's not homework as we think of it. So here's basically what we would have for that chapter. The topic is a fruitful ecological solution. And I turn to one of my favorite philosophers, Wangari Maathai, from Kenya. And so I talk about why this issue has proven important in my philosophy travels. The issues that are in the book are all weighing on people's minds. So we know that we have environmental issues both in our homes and in our local communities and globally. So I talk a bit about the issue. And then I have a section called Prepping for Kenya. So there are things that you can read. There are things that you could go online, for example, and check out the Masai Mara National Reserve. There are movies you can watch. The wonderful movie, The First Grader, directed by Justin Chadwick, which is a marvelous film to be introduced to Kenya. And then I introduce the reader to the philosopher, to Wangari Maathai, and her take on this issue and how she addressed Kenya's very dramatic, overwhelming ecological issues. And so that's what the homework would be, and what you know is what the dinner topic will be. So I give the topic, it's a quote from her, from Maathai, and sort of set up what the conversation might be like for dinner. And then philosophy dinner clubs almost always, in my experience, rotate who's hosting it, but there are lots of suggestions for what guests can bring. So you can bring boiled peanuts, let's say, or grilled plantains, or Maathai loved figs. And so there are suggestions for what the guests bring, and then also music. And a lot of people like to listen to the music to get into the mood before the dinner. And then the recipes that the host would provide. And for Kenya, it's squash and apple soup. Both squash and apples are so important in that particular culture. And so people can learn about where the food is coming from and shop for it and that sort of thing. And then one of the most popular recipes in the book is No Need African Seed Bread. And that's the other thing that the host would fix. And then at the end, Rob, there's Kenya to go, and there are more things that you might want to read, more things to listen to, some more music perhaps. Maathai often referred to herself as a hummingbird, and so there's a movie that you can look at that explains why. She said the hummingbird just does the best it can. That's all any of us can do, is the best we can when it comes to the environment. And then it finishes with the resources that were used in that chapter. So it does require a commitment of time on the part of the diners that they are going to read about the topic. They're going to think about it. They're going to make the appetizers, pick up the appetizers, and participate and give it their full attention. I think that's universally what I'm hearing from around the country, is that when you do make this commitment that once a month we're going to do this and it's going to matter and we're going to learn from each other, that's the trick, is making the commitment of time.
How do you pick that guest list of people who you're going to ask to make that commitment?
Well, what people are doing, a variety of things. Some people are mixing it up and say maybe a couple of family members, a neighbor or two, a couple of colleagues. Some people are inviting, the recipes serve eight, and some people are choosing four people, three people, something like that, and then they pick somebody. So it's people who didn't know each other before. So there are a lot of different ways to go about choosing who you might want to have, and the important thing is to make sure that they are looking for this good conversation and will make the commitment of time.
So you sit people down. They're not philosophers. In your experience, how long does it take before that conversation really gets rolling?
Well, if I've done my job, it shouldn't take very long, because in talking about the issue, whatever that may be, say persistence and grace, I explain why it's an issue, write about it in a way that should help people talk about it. And I think that, you know, if philosophy is the art of clear thinking, then I think we all have the potential to philosophize. I remember I was giving a talk once, and there were some child philosophers there. They were in the third grade, and they did philosophy three times a week at their school. And so I was speaking to an adult audience, but they were there. So I asked the children, I said, do you have anything you'd like to say to the group? And one child said, yes, I would like to say, don't feel that you can't do philosophy just because you're a grown-up. So children do philosophy. They're natural philosophers. We all have the ability to think and reflect. I think we're starved for good conversation. The world's very noisy, and we're moving really fast. And to sit down and spend time together, I think, fulfills a real, it's soul food, and I think that's what we're hungry for.
Are kids ever part of these?
Well, not, I mean, everywhere I go, pretty much, you know, whether it's a picnic with children or whatever, usually there's some food involved with them. I think it's possible for children to be involved, although I wasn't thinking about including them when I was writing the book, but I don't think it's out of the question at all.
We're continuing our discussion about the Philosopher's Table after we take a look at the news, and we'll take your calls. Do you feel like philosophy is a part of your daily life? Do you wish it were more so? And do you like this idea? Do you think you want to try this and ask for some advice? Getting people together for a philosopher's dinner, a philosophy supper. Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send an email, talk@WPR.org. or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Marietta McCarty is with us. Her book is The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, and we'll pick that up in just a little bit. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up, we'll look at age discrimination against baby boomers trying to get back into the workforce, often after losing their jobs in the recession. Right now, we're taking your calls on philosophy. Is philosophy an important part of your life? Do you think there's been a mistake that we've separated philosophy from our daily lives? Do you talk about it with your friends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking to Marietta McCarty. Her book is The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club. She's got philosophical questions, a little background research, and recipes to pull together a group of eight or so people and chat about philosophy. Marietta, what do we get? I tend to think of philosophy as a solitary activity. You mentioned that a little earlier. What do we learn when we start talking about these ideas with other people around the dinner table?
Well, I think, in a way, stories aren't just about our lives. They are our lives. And I think the narrative that happens when people are gathered around the dinner table is so important. So, for example, the first chapter is the joy of single tasking, doing one thing at a time and doing it well rather than running in many different directions. And so I think when people share anecdotes or things that they would like to do or what makes them this difficult for them to slow down and concentrate and be attentive to the moment, that we learn so much from each other. And what many diners are telling me is that they're learning about not only the people at the dinner table with them, but they're learning about themselves. They're learning that, you know, they had ideas that you know, were faulty, things are opening up, new possibilities will present themselves for better living. And what drove the book, Rob, wasn't the food. The food is what brings people together, but it's the topics that drove the book. I think they're the ones that people really would like to talk about.
And do you see a lot of sort of breakthrough moments as people are talking and maybe something that had been muddling around in their brain for a while starts to gel as they're talking about it with other people at the dinner club?
Oh, absolutely. For example, in the chapter on persistence and grace, I talk in that chapter about anger and its futility and what unchecked anger can do to our lives. And so with this sort of analysis of anger and the damage that it does comes this realization that, you know, I can do better than that. I don't need that. And the philosopher I use is from Burma is Aung San Suu Kyi, who in her nonviolent, passionate, resilient way has broken through the military dictatorship there and opened that country to democracy. It's a powerful lesson in persistence and grace and what can be done when anger is controlled. Suu Kyi asks questions. She wants to get to know people who disagree with her. Her goal is not to prove that she's right. So I think what happens, I'm hoping for at dinner tables, and what I enjoy seeing so much, Rob, is what I would call a soft relationship, that you have this ease at the dinner table of yielding and listening. I mean, you know, we don't listen very well, and we need to learn to listen again and let people say what they have to say and have thoughts hang there and ask questions. Questions are much more interesting than statements. And so there's a certain tone and temperament that happens. And I hear all the time, you know, people are, when they think about simple pleasures and what really matters, and they choose to restore friendships because they realize that that's really life's greatest simple pleasure in many ways, and it doesn't cost a thing except our time. So I've seen radical changes in people's lives, and I've also seen slow, steady changes in people's lives, and it's all done in a happy atmosphere. Sometimes it's emotional when people are sharing things from their past, but it's always with one giant step forward as you push your chair back from the dinner table.
I wonder, though, I mean, you mentioned this ease of a conversation, this mellow environment, but it's, for me, I think I'd feel a little awkward. You know, I've got these people who I usually talk about the Packer game and the weather with, and we're now talking about these deep issues, or maybe a total stranger I've never met, and we're trying to figure out how these deep issues affect our daily lives. How long does it take to overcome that initial, what I would see as awkwardness?
Well, there are a lot of suggestions in the book for how to do that and what it means to have a good conversation. I talk about up front in the first chapter on the joy of single tasking. I don't find, Rob, in my experience, that it is hard for people. I think, you know, maybe the third dinner will be a little easier than the first one. But when you're talking about a philosophy course in college and you're talking about deep issues which may be abstract and removed from someone's life, that's not like talking about, let's say, the chapter set in China is a slow dance with nature, and it's talking about the reality that everything changes and the one constant in life is change. And so how much easier and better would our lives be if we could accept that and give newness a try and give change a try each day of our lives, because that is the reality and the damage that comes from pretending that anything can stay the same forever. So I don't think of these as deep issues in that they're difficult to discuss. I think of them as priority issues on the path towards good living. And what I see with each dinner is that clarity improves. Minds get sharper, questions get better. It's just easier to have a conversation. And you're right, what might make you feel awkward at that first dinner is that we don't sit down and talk with each other at length very often. And so getting used to that, I think, is the biggest thing. But people are drawn to it. They savor it. And that's why it's important that the people that you have in your group want to make this commitment. So the kind of tone and temperament I'm talking about at the table comes from a willingness to listen and not to prove a point, not to be right, but just to continue to talk about the topic and understand it better.
One of the toughest topics for me to grasp looking through the suggested was you had a chapter a month on with Immanuel Kant, who I don't get. And on the upside, for us in Wisconsin, you gave us some bait. You included brats on the menu.
I know. I know. Well, I haven't been to Wisconsin, but if I ever do, I want to be welcome there. So I knew that I had to have brats in the book for you. I didn't mention the Green Bay Packers. I there was no way I could do that. But but the food is the thing that really makes it work. You know, I went to one town and did two book events of the same day. One had food and one didn't. A lot of the people were the same. The event that had food that brought people together who did not know each other was completely different. It had a feel to it that invited people to speak and open up and talk with each other and know that they would be respected. Nobody was trying to win a debate. So Immanuel Kant, most people don't get him. He made sure in his writing that not very many people would understand him, but that's why I have a job, is making it. What he's saying is not that complicated, and it is very interesting to think about what drives the decisions we make. Is it emotion? Do we think about consequences? Do we think about motivation? Those are things that it's easy to talk about, and I hope it's easy to talk about, and that's my goal with the book.
As part of your wider mission of bringing philosophy into our daily lives, how do you think we ended up with this separation where some of us think philosophy isn't relevant and we don't talk about these things?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I think that what happened is, and this often happens in academia, is that the topic itself becomes removed from the lives of ordinary people and becomes sort of the province of this academic club. And so what makes that club going, it keeps it going and makes the membership secure, is that you've got this body of knowledge that's yours, and you know what it is, and it belongs with you, and you impart it to your students, and they give you the information back that you're imparting to them. That's the antithesis of what I think the art of clear thinking is. I think it's about discussion. My students and readers say they love it that I am learning with them, which I certainly am. This has been a very, in a way, selfish journey for me because I learn all the time. So I think that there has been some intentional desire to make, you know, you feel that you can't go to an art gallery, for example. The art critics might make you feel that way, that you can't go to opera because you haven't really studied it. You can't do philosophy because it was too complicated in college, and I think that that's really unfortunate. And I think that we need to come together and think again, talk again.
Marietta, that's a good place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Happy Labor Day.
To you, too. That's Marietta McCarty. Her new book is The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, Monthly Conversation, Music, and Recipes. Coming up next, we'll talk about age bias in the workplace with a legal expert who covers age discrimination issues. This is Central Time.